Introduce the main speaker for the evening, Dean A. from Morro Bay.
Wow. Hi, I'm Dean, and I'm an alcoholic. I drove down today, and there's some type of holiday coming up or something, so it's a little crowded on the highway, so I'm a little bit out of it, so I'm going to do the best I can. Nice to be here. This young lady's going to be very tired with her hands, and because I speak kind of fast. There's guys in there. I also like to thank the front row here, guys that I got sober with, that were here when I got here, they're sitting in the front row. They've shown up just out of the clear blue sky, and it's just amazing to me. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm not a real professional speaker or anything like that, but I absolutely love the program Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got to just tell you what happened and what it was like and what happened, and hopefully somebody will get something out of this. And I'd like to welcome the newcomers. I was a newcomer once, and some days I still feel like a newcomer, and I'm just glad that you guys are here, and please, I hope I say something that you hear that just motivates you to stick around and try to do this thing. I have to tell you a little bit about me real quick, and I was born in Chicago. Nothing special. I did the third grade twice. I liked it so much they held me back and got another one. I didn't fit in. I wore these Coke bottle glasses, real thick little things, and I got teased a lot. And I was always different. My brain didn't work, and I talked fast, and you know, just a weird little kid. And I had no idea what the hell was wrong with me. And the neat thing about it, though, from the time I was a little guy, I played the drums. And I started off with the wooden spoons on the pots and pans. And when I was 6, I got my first drum set. And when I was 10, I got my first full-size drum set. And I took lessons from a guy who was in big bands and played at the old, in Chicago, at the Edgewater Beach Hotel and stuff. And when I was 11 years old, I got to play with the 17-piece band behind me at the Chicago Blues Festival or Jazz Festival, whatever they called it. So I wanted to be a famous drummer. I was positive. That's what it is. And I played music. I grew up in the 50s in Chicago. I tell you how old I am. And I listened to all the famous drummers. And I played to them. And then I was going to be a famous drummer. Well, let me tell you what happened. In 1962, we moved out to Coronado. And I was playing the drums. And I'm walking down the street one day. And there's music coming out of this house. And I just went in the door, and these guitar player guys were there, old guys. I mean, they were like 17, 18 years old, you know. And I was like 12, you know. And I said, hey, you guys need a drummer? And they said, you play the drums? I said, yeah, you know. And I had my Coke bottle glasses on, and, you know, I was all set. So I go home. I live like a block away, and I get my dad and my brother to help me haul my drum set down there. And I started playing with these guys in 62, and we did all the surf songs and stuff like that. And we could play in Coronado at the time. You could play at the Amphib Base and North Island and, you know, at all the places. So we played a lot, you know, and I played band. Well, one night, I got introduced to Bacardi, and I liked Bacardi. Oh, my God, I was 12 years old, and that little bird and that little green bottle, it was great. Pretty soon, to make a long story short about the drumming part, I started to want to drink Bacardi rather than be a famous drummer. And it was all about playing in the band and getting my Bacardi, my little half pints, and then I went up to a pint, and that's basically what I lived for. I spent my whole junior high school days playing in bands. I played in high school band, all that stuff. I was just this weird guy. And finally, about the junior year, between my junior and senior year in 1967, other stuff started showing up in Coronado. And, you know, the green stuff and all that other stuff. And I liked all of it. And I tell you what, I was fascinated with anything that came in a pill or whatever. And I spent my whole senior year high. I don't remember much. They tell me I had a great time. I don't know. But I got out of high school, and I spent 2 more years playing around. In 1970, I decided to quit playing the drums. I was never going to be famous, and there were 10 guys that were better than me that I knew. And I went to work for this band up in San Francisco, a couple of friends of mine. And we were the opening act for, like, the Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane. And I never met those people, you know, but because we would go on at 8 o'clock, play our little half-hour set, and then go, you know, type of thing. And I was a roadie and the equipment manager and everything, you know. And I spent 2 years up there, and they finally asked me to leave. They didn't care for my girlfriend at the time, and they said either you go or you both go. You know, she goes or you both go. So I came back to Coronado, and we got married, and because I liked her so much, you know. And we went over to Europe, and for the summer, and we saved our money. We went over to Europe for something. And while I was over there, I was in Bengen, Switzerland, 6,000 feet up the side of Jungfrau Mountain above Interlaken. And there was this guy in this club. We worked at a hotel. And there was this guy in this club down the way that all the employees of the hotels hung out at this club. And he had two turntables and a little mixer, and he was playing the Rolling Stones and old Motown stuff. And I, wow, I like that. And I had a record collection anyway. So I came back in September of 1972, and I built my first little box, and I put two turntables in there, a little mixer. And everybody laughed at me. Nobody's going to pay you money to play records at a dance, you know. And I did my very first mobile music show in 1972, October, Halloween party. And I hooked up with the radio station, KDEO Radio, out in El Cajon. They were the oldie station in town. And we would go out and promote the station, and the DJs would come, and I built another unit. Then I built another one. And a couple of years after I started with KDEO, about a year later, this movie came out called American Graffiti. Everybody, all of a sudden, we did the grand opening of it. We did the premieres at the theater. They had four of my machines out there. We had hula hoop contests and limbo contests. And I was passing out cards left and right. And pretty soon, this thing just took off. And we're doing shows every Friday and Saturday night, spinning records, you know, doing 45s. And it got bigger and bigger. And finally, in 1975, I had rented a unit to this guy, this DJ that I knew. And he called me up and he said, "We're putting a brand new radio station on the air. You want to come and bring your units over and you know, come work for us?" And at the time, the music was changing. It was like cut the cake and pick up the pieces, and the old, you know, the dance stuff was starting out. So I went to work, and this radio station went on the air in April 1975, B100 FM, and we were the B100 boogie machine, and ended up with five of these things, and the radio station became number one. And there was number one station in San Diego. You could see it at the Muscular Dystrophy Telethon. We were doing dances at all the junior highs, all the high schools, you know. And I built another unit. And right when I built my sixth unit, another little movie came out called Saturday Night Fever. And the next thing you know, I'm in this white outfit doing the thing like this. You know? And I went from the oldies shows to the Disco Fever show. But the weird thing about it was, shortly after that, Urban Cowboy came out. So next thing you know, I got hay bales, and I'm, you know. And then another movie came out called Animal House. So we went back to doing all these shows again. So I'm spinning hula hoops. And, oh, it was an amazing time. But the big problem I had, though, is during this whole period that I was working for B100 and stuff like that, I had a drinking problem. And I couldn't stop drinking. And I kept screwing up things, you know. And I'd do junior high dances. And below the console, I'd have my little porta bar, you know, with the canned cocktails and stuff like that, and pour them in my glass. And I was driving, and I was doing a lot of these shows. And I also started in 1975, I started building discos. And I went to Mexico, and I Guadalajara and Acapulco and stuff, and I put together the sound and lights for a total of 19 of these things. I did the Harbor House, the Seaport Village and stuff. But everything I did was evolved around alcohol. And I never figured it out. All the sound company, the mobile music company, everything I did was alcohol related. And come to about 1985, I was on the road. I worked for a multimedia company, and I did all these multimedia shows all over the world for Bridgestone Tires and American Airlines and stuff like that. And I was really ill. I was hurting, you know. And I was doing sleeping pills at night to go to sleep, and I was smoking that stuff during the day to just keep calm down and take the pain away. And I was drinking at the same time. And I come back from one of the tours that I was on. And I found out that the neighbor comes and he says, "You know, your girlfriend's sleeping with her boss in your house, you know." And it, like, put me over the edge. And I was like, working. I just totally worked the whole time. I was doing 16, 20-hour days. I had employees, you know, all this stuff. And all of a sudden, I hear that my girlfriend's sleeping with her boss in my house. And I got to tell you, I was really tired by then. I had spent all this time from 1972, or basically 1970 to 1985, running this business and doing all this stuff, and I was tired, and I didn't want to do it anymore, and I had an incredible drinking problem, and I couldn't stop drinking, and I was losing stuff. So the only answer to all this and the depression and everything was I took 35 sleeping pills and drank all the vodka I could drink and just wanted to go to sleep. I just didn't want to feel anymore, you know. And even though I was really successful in the public's eye and all this stuff, and I knew famous people, and I worked with like Robin Williams and stuff like that, inside I was just this drunk, you know. And I didn't deserve all this adulation and stuff like that, you know. Even when I put contacts on, I started looking better. I still didn't deserve what, you know, what had gone on. So they took me over, they got me in Claremont, one of my roadies found me, took me to the old Mission Bay Hospital, and I spent 4 days in a coma, and then they took me over to Coronado, and found that my gallbladder was needed to come out, my appendix was ready to burst, and they found cancer for the first time, and my stomach was bleeding. It turns out my stomach was allergic to vodka, and it would bleed, you know? So I had like 9 ulcer surgeries, you know? And so what I decided to do in 1985 is get rid of that mobile music business. I had the sound company, and I had my disco building and stuff, and the sound company was enough. So I don't need this. I don't need the employees. I don't need to be chasing these DJs down and all this stuff. So I sold the mobile disco business, and I just focused on doing the sound and building the discos. Well, about 1988, I was at the same spot again. Except this was worse, because I had gone over to Tokyo to do a show for Bridgestone Tires, and you know how it says in the book that we get tight at the wrong moment? Well, we were there for 6 days or 7 days. The only time we had to do anything was the last day. We had to set up the show, do the show, let the chairman of the board do his little speech, take it down and go home. Well, that's the day I got the drunkest. And the chairman of the board of Bridgestone Tires is up there, and the microphone's going, you know, and I was just drunk on my ass sitting at the soundboard, you know, in Tokyo, and getting papers. And I started losing clients and all that. So 1988, I realized I was in the same spot I was in 1985. Yeah, my life was all destroyed, basically, and I was losing all my sound company, I was losing everything. So I decided I didn't want to turn 40 and be an alcoholic and be hooked on all that other stuff. So I sold my sound company, and I started going into treatment centers. And I hit almost every treatment center in San Diego in that 2-year period. And I ended up, the first one I ended up with was Mesa Vista Hospital. And I got to spend 28 days in Mesa Vista with the big key. You know, the room that has the big key downstairs. Because I had this psychosis going on from all this alcohol and this other stuff I was doing. I was nuttier than hell. And I'm still a little nuts. But I was even worse then. They would pump me up full of Thorazine, right? And so I'd be all on Thorazine, and the door would open, and I'd be heading towards the door. You know, and like doing this thing. Hey, somebody get Dean. We grab Dean and get him back. After 28 days, they finally moved me into their treatment program. And I didn't understand the thing they were saying. They would take us out to these meetings, and we'd come back, and people would talk about the big book, and I didn't understand any of it, you know. And somebody would say stuff, and I didn't understand what they were saying. So I didn't get the message of Alcoholics Anonymous somehow during that time. And I went to treatment program, went out and drank right away again. Got back to Mesa Vista again. They put me upstairs in the big key room. And then they put me in the cognitive therapy program. Now, I don't know what cognitive... We made moccasins. And that was going to cure my alcoholism, right? And I made the best moccasins. But I never understand what the hell they were trying to do to help me. So I spent this whole 2-year period from 88 to 90... going in and out of these treatment centers. The only one I didn't go to was the McDonald's Center. I didn't want to go to any place run by a clown, you know. But I hit all the rest. And at the end of at the end of 1989, I was really in bad shape. And I didn't have my businesses anymore. I had money from the sale of my businesses and stuff. And somebody suggested I go to Rancho Labrie out in Del Zura. And I talked to them, and they said, we'll take you, but it's going to be $18,000 cash. And I had to write him a check, and you had to commit to 90 days, you know. So I went out there, and I lasted 87 days, whole 87 days with no alcohol. And I was going crazy, and my brain was just going off, and I couldn't stay focused, and I didn't know what the heck was wrong with me. And in 87 days, I got out of there, and I called her up, and that I met there, and she came and picked me up, and she was in love, you know. And took me home. I went back, and I started this off the way I was before, except this time comes around 1990, right at the start of the year there, I was worse than I ever was, and I couldn't stop drinking, and I couldn't stop doing all that other crazy stuff, and once again my life was screwed, and all my family and my friends left me, and I had nothing. And my parents had died in 88 and 89, and I took care of my dad a little bit while I was going in all these treatment centers, and I took all his pills, from his cancer and everything like that, and I just took them all and drank all the vodka I could, and I just wanted to get out of here. I just didn't want to live anymore, because I couldn't stop drinking, and I couldn't stop hurting people. I couldn't stop doing all the crap I was doing. And this time, this girl came over who cleaned my house, and she came and found me laying on the floor, and apparently in the middle of the night I had tried to get up, and I broke my nose open, and it was bleeding, and it was turning blue in the pool of blood. And so, piss off Coronado just one more time. They closed 4th Street and 3rd Street and took me from the ambulance over to the park across the street, put me in the life flight helicopter, took me over to Mercy Hospital to the trauma unit. And I almost made it that time, but, you know, no luck. So I got out of there. I convinced them everything was okay. I was just, you know, an accidental, I call it intentional overdose, but it was accidental. I didn't mean to do anything. And what I needed to do was get out of Coronado. So I headed up to Canada, right? I had met this guy at Rancho Labrie in Canada who had a bag. He had one of those bags and all that stuff. He had a vodka problem. Well, I went up there to help him with his vodka problem. And we spent the winter, January, February, and March in Canada drinking his vodka. And I helped him, and it was wonderful. And I went from there down to Humboldt County, and then I went to L.A., and then down to Mexico. I saw one of my friends down there who I had built a disco for, and he had a guy who needed a disco. So I went to San Felipe, and I hung out there for a while. And I just spent the whole 5 years just, I would get jobs, I'd lose jobs, I'd go here, I'd go there. And everywhere I went, there was my alcohol problem. And I couldn't stop drinking to save my life, and all that, and all the other crazy stuff that goes with it. And what happened was I was getting jobs, and I was working doing casino surveillance systems. And I like the security stuff, and that's what I do now. But I was sitting in my bar at Paradise Road over in Vegas, and right across behind the MGM Grand Hotel there. And I was living in a nice trailer park with my own room in a trailer and $200 a month, you know, with this old guy. And these two guys come up, and I'm sitting at this bar. And these two guys come up with the suits and the ties and the whole bit, and they flash their badges. Well, apparently they frown on people having drinking problems who have Nevada State gaming licenses to install security systems. They don't like that for some reason. And they told me that you Dean Atkinson? I said, yeah. You know, and I had my pitcher in front of me and my beer, and I just hanging on for dear life under the bar. You know, we came to talk to you about this, you know. And they said they were going to take my license away. Well, by this time, this was a $12 an hour job. You know, I had lost everything. I had absolutely nothing. I was sitting in this bar drinking with a job at $12 an hour, and all I heard them say was they were going to take away the last little bit of thing that I had to drink. The last money I had to buy a drink, they were going to stop it. They were going to take it away from me. And at this time, I had spent literally $500,000. It was gone. From the time I sold my businesses and I started these treatment centers in 1988 to 1995, every single cent my parents left me, every bit of money that I had, everything was gone. I had absolutely nothing. I had no driver's license. My teeth were all rotted out. I was pulling my own teeth out so I could buy alcohol instead of paying the dentist. You know, and every night I pull my teeth out at night and I put them next to the bed and I think about this time that I had, as fun time I had as an alcoholic, you know. So what happens is they told me to take my license away, so I went back to my beautiful little mobile home there living with this old guy, and he wasn't around. I went in his medicine cabinet, and once again, I needed to get out of here. You know, I just didn't want to be around. I didn't want to try to live without alcohol. So I took everything in his medicine cabinet and drank all the vodka I could, and he came home and he found me. I ended up in the hospital. And my sister flew me back to Coronado, to San Diego. She wouldn't let me stay at her house. By then, she was done with me. And my family was pretty much done with me. So I went and stayed with a drunk friend of mine named Rich, who lived on the island. And he took me in, and we spent the next couple of days drinking. And on April 3rd, I went to my family doctor. And I was sick again. I was really sick. And my ulcers were bleeding, and I was in really bad shape. And I'm sitting there, and I'm waiting in the room, and he comes in, and we start talking. I tell him what's going on and stuff like that. And he says, let me hold it right there. He said, Dean, you know you're an alcoholic, right? He said, I'm tired of fixing you. I'm tired of putting you back together. I got this big monster scar. And he wanted to put a zipper on it so he can just get in and out quick, you know. And he said, I can't help you. And then he told me that he himself was an alcoholic, and he had 25 years. And he said, I can't watch you destroy yourself anymore. And you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he gave me back my money. I had paid up cash to go see him. And the last little cent I had, I borrowed it from my sister, I guess. And I took the money, and I went right to the bar, and I started drinking again. And on April 11th, I had this moment of clarity. I was out of money. I was out of teeth. I was out of driver's license. I had nothing, you know. And I called that rancher, the breed place. And I said, I'm in trouble. I just spent all my inheritance. I spent all my money. I don't have a dime in my name. I can't stop drinking. I can't stop using. And I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. And she goes, Dean, the last time you were here, you weren't really willing to do what you had to do. And I said, no, I wasn't. She goes, you didn't get really willing this time? And I said, okay, yeah. And she said, can you get here tomorrow? And I had no car. Rich didn't have a car. Rich was one of those guys that got so many DUIs that the judge told him if you either drink or you drive a car. So he sold his car, right? And then he got a bicycle. And he started riding his bike from the bar in Coronado, Little Coronado. He started getting drunk on his bike ticket, so he sold his bike. And he started walking, you know. Then he started getting tickets walking, being drunk in public. So he did the next best thing. He made arrangements with the cab company to deliver his alcohol from the Alabama liquor store. So he never had to go out of his house. And that type of guy Rich was. Let me tell you what happened to Rich. So make a long story short, I went April 12, 1995. I got in. A friend of mine came and picked me up. He said he was going to take me up to Dulzer and get me out. I wasn't coming back down the hill. I was going and not coming back. And I arrived at Rancho Libre in April 12, 1995. And when I got there, one of the counselors who was there before gave me this little card. And he had written on it. He knew I was coming. He wrote and I said, please help me to be willing to do what I have to do today to stay sober. And he had it all written out in the card. He said, Dean, I want you to, every time you want to run, every time you want to get out of here, every time you want things your way, whatever, I want you to read this card. And I want you to repeat it over and over again. And I did. And I, please help me to be willing to do what I have to do. Well, they started taking us to these AA meetings. And I didn't really understand what was going on. But I stayed there and I showed up to everything. And I just, as the alcohol left my brain, I got fuzzier and fuzzier. And most people clear out and they're looking good and they're styling after about a month and stuff. Well, after a month, I wasn't styling at all, you know. And Mike remembers, and Colleen probably remembers, and Joey I know remembers, you know. And these guys were at Pathfinders when I arrived. So they talked me into going to a recovery home, and I didn't know what a recovery home was. I had no idea. I barely knew anything about AA, and I definitely didn't know about a recovery home. So I went to Pathfinders, and this great big guy was behind the desk named Stan. And he interviewed me, man. He was like this, and he's looking down at me. And I'm 46 years old. I'm 6 feet tall. And I got my emotions are right here, you know. And he's telling me a story. And oh man, you know. And he said, "Are you going to be really willing to do what you have to do?" "I'll do anything, man. Believe me, you know. This will beat me, you know." And he was big, and I felt so small and so torn up and so beat up, and you know, and I'm missing teeth, and I wasn't pretty, you know. And so I went to Pathfinder. They finally called me, and I got to go in there May 17th, 1995. And man, I didn't know what was going on. These guys would come up, and they'd grab me. "Hey, welcome home, man!" You know, and I'd check in my wallet, and I go, "Well, I ain't got no money," you know. And the neat thing happened to me while I was there. These wonderful people would come in from Alcoholics Anonymous, and they'd hold meetings there, you know. And the 1 o'clock guys like Joey and Mike and stuff. And I started listening to these guys, and I actually got to see Mike here get his 10-year cake. You know, and I knew he's a lying bastard, but he, 10 years, you know. And I would listen to what he was saying at the podium, and then I started finding it in this book, you know. And I just started hearing the right things. And the first thing I heard and the thing that people showed me in this wonderful book is that we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And to show other people how we recovered is the purpose of this book. And I started reading the thing, and I couldn't understand. The words were jumping all over the page and stuff. And as I got more and more without alcohol, my brain got fuzzier and fuzzier. But I hooked up with a guy named Ray. And Ray was my first sponsor. He was fresh out of the house and stuff like that. And Ray's whole thing was, call me every day at 5, right? So I call him, "Hey, good morning, Ray. It's 5 o'clock, you know." And he said, "Okay, call me tomorrow." You know, and he hang up, right? One day I called him up. I said, "Hey, Ray, it's 5 o'clock. He said, "Dean, it's Sunday." And I said, "Oh, okay, don't call me on Sunday." So I had to get a new sponsor, right? So I hooked up with a guy named Keith. Now, Keith was a wonderful man. I love Keith, and he's still with my spiritual and service sponsor today. And Keith and I went through the first three steps together and stuff like that, and I didn't understand what the hell he was talking about, you know. But we did this real emotional third-step prayer on the patio with Pathfinders, and also, and then he whips out a pad and a pen. And he said, I need you to write your fourth step. And I went, what? What the hell are you talking about? I just did my third step. I don't know. And so I got rid of him. And what the hell? You know? So then I hook up with Mike. And Mike didn't want to hear anything about one, two, and three. He said, you're gonna learn the fourth step. And he started me in this big book and showed me about the resentment list and showed me about the middle column and what it was about and then what it affected. And he showed me all the stuff in the fourth step. So I'm writing this stuff out. And he's checking on me at the house three, you know, coming by. How you doing? You know, and I'm writing like a fool. And so, and I'm just lying. Everything I put down was a lie and wasn't, you know, was. And finally, I finished the darn thing. But I was too unique and different and special to share it with Mike. So I got rid of him too, you know. And I had to share it with my therapist, right? And I went to my therapist and they said, is that all? And I said, whoa, man, I'm, you know. So the neat thing happened to me, I hooked up with this old Jewish guy, Al. And Alan was a banker for Citibank, and he was 68 when I hooked up with him, and I was like 46. And he didn't want to be my sponsor. And I asked him a couple times, oh, no, no way, you know. And finally, I go to Stan, the big guy, and I said, Stan, I really want that guy to be my sponsor. He said, go ask him right now. And he's in a group of men, you know. So I go up and I said, you know, it'd be really good for a guy like you to have someone like me as a sponsee. And he said, he's looking around like this, you know, and everybody's looking at him. And he finally said, okay, you know, I'll do it. Turns out I was his only sponsee ever. But he started me in the front of the book, and we started reading, and it all started to make sense, and I kept hearing all this stuff that Joey and Mike and Mary Beth and Colleen were talking about over and over again, and I got to the part about the second step and says, you know, I have to read it, because my brain just turned off again. I love like being EDD or ADD. It says, when we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance on the spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. Our ideas didn't work, but the God idea did. And I started figuring out that if I was ever going to get sober and I was going to get this problem over with, I was going to have to find some type of power greater than myself, or higher power, or spirit of the universe is my favorite, or God, or good early direction, or group of drunks, or grumpy old dudes, or whatever you want, you know. I was going to have to find something to help me. And then he showed me over here on page 53, he says, when we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we couldn't postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that God either is or he isn't. What is our choice to be? And I had to finally come to grips with the fact that I needed to find the God. And I had lost the power of choice to drink. I had no way in the world, no defense against that first drink. And I had to find some type of God. And he convinced me to start writing another four step. And this one didn't have as many lies in it. And I was more honest. And every one I did, and every time I wrote, I did a little bit better and stuff. But he motivated me with the promises in the big book. And he would show me stuff in the big book. And he showed me this thing on page 75. And it's the fifth step promises. And he said, I want you to read this every time you work on your fourth step, because this is what's going to happen to you when you do your fourth step. And it says, on the fifth step, it said, we pocket our pride and we go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. And once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fear is far from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. Where we may have had certain spiritual beliefs, we now begin to have a spiritual experience. And then the thought that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. And the big one for me is we feel we're walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. You know? And that's what happened to me. I did my fourth step, and I was a little bit more honest, and I did it. I told him everything I could possibly tell him, and I started feeling hope. And I still had all this guilt and shame and remorse for all the stuff I did to people and all the people I hurt with my actions of being an alcoholic. And I still hurt, but I had hope. And we got to the sixth and seventh, and I was so entirely ready, like they say right here, I was so entirely ready to have God remove those defects of characters and old habits and attitudes and behaviors that I actually got on my knees and I started praying. And I didn't use the word God for a long time. I really liked that spirit of the universe thing, you know. But I started praying to help me. And then I started practicing being a little more honest. and doing the right thing and just simple things and treating people nicely and trying to be a different person. And I started to really grow and change, and Keith got me in the service. Him and Joey, they needed a coffee maker at Pathfinder's, right, the Friday night meeting. So they said, we need a coffee maker. And again, Keith goes, Dean will do it. Joey said, I second the nomination. Mary Beth said, close the nominations. And next thing you know, I'm the coffee maker. I'm the head mofo in charge of coffee at Pathfinder's on Friday night, you know? And the weird thing about it was I did that for like 5 months. It was only a one-month commitment. But apparently at the steering committee, they would say, oh, Dean needs to keep doing the coffee. You know? So I did it for 5 months. A coffee maker, me, you know? And the wonderful thing happened. I got into service, and I really got into taking care of the literature for the men's meeting. And then I got when I had a year sober, I got to be a GSR, and I was a GSR for the Friday night meeting, and I was the literature committee for that. And I loved it, and I got into the spring roundup, and I worked my way up. I was a coffee cup seller, and then I sold T-shirts, and I worked my way all the way up to the spring roundup to co-treasurer. They're going to let me write the checks, you know? And I loved it. I fell into AA, and I just loved every single bit of it. And the neat thing about it, the biggest promise, am I almost out of time? How am I doing? How much time do I got? I can't do 15 anymore. Hey, so the neat thing about it was I got the 9-step promises. You guys all know the 9-step promises, right? And the big one is you suddenly realize that God's doing for you what you couldn't do for yourself. I was just taking the action. I was just walking through it. I was just pretending. Like sometimes I just pretend I was there, you know. And somehow I was staying sober, and just clicking off days. It was like, wow, this is really working for me. And then I found the biggest thing happened when I was really out there. I was making amends. Alan was really big on just going through the book and taking it in order, you know. Don't get ahead of the 9-step when you're on your 5th, you know, that type of deal. But I found this thing on page 84, right after the promises. And we're talking about the 2nd step, you know. And it says, come to believe that a power greater than ourselves will restore us to sanity. Well, all through the book, they talk about that insanity of our drinking, that this time I'm not going to get behind the wheel of a car and drive, or I'm only going to have one, you know. And you guys can fill in the thing, you know, better than I can. But I found this promise on page 85 that I just said, wow, this makes so much sense. By the time I got up there, and I was out there making my amends, and I was having all sorts of fun with recovery, and I was doing the deal, I found this thing. And it says right here, and we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we will recoil from it as if a hot flame. We will react sanely and normally, and we'll find that this has happened automatically. We will see how our new attitude towards liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it. Neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We are neither cocky nor afraid. This is our experience. This is how we react, so long as we keep in a fit spiritual condition. I have to work every day. I have ADD really bad, and I thought I was just crazy, you know. And now I have to work at it. And I finally discovered why I was so different, and from taking the steps and what I have to do about it. And the thing that helps me the most is prayer. I pray every day, and I just hold on to my ass and I go for the ride. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new here, if the information's in the book, and there are people that will help you. And no matter what your problems are, you know, they told me I was manic depressive and bipolar and all this crap. And in fact, I was in the mental institution, and I had Thorazine, and I had insurance, so they ran me through all the tests and all this stuff. And they gave me an IQ test while I was on Thorazine. And needless to say, I didn't do so well, right? So my family doctor, who's known me since 1962, he gets this stuff, and I'm in there, and I'm complaining to him. I had like 2 years sober. I go, oh, man, my brain is still just takes off on me and goes, and I can't reel it back in again. And he said, Dean, realize this might be as good as you get. You know, and he started looking at it, and he said, okay, let's see, you rotted your teeth out to the roots, so you have no teeth. He said, your heart's this big, flabby thing instead of a tight muscle, and your age is rapidly catching up to your IQ, you know. He said, give yourself a break. You know, this might be as good as you ever get. And I'm accepting of that today. You know, this might be as good as I ever get. I've been blessed with being able to start my life all over again as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. I got out of the entertainment business officially in 1990, and I started doing casino surveillance systems. And I love behind the scenes. I love wires, and I love twisting stuff and doing it. And it turns out that I have this gift. I can take a whole bunch of little pieces, little tiny pieces of things, that, and make a system and put it together as one big system. And I just returned from Africa. I was over there for 14 months working at one of our military bases over there. And I got to do security for the whole base. I was the guy in charge of all the security systems, the cameras and stuff. And this, I just got my top secret clearance. Just like 4 or 5 months ago, I got top secret. Me! You know? And that ought to scare the hell out of you. You know? But the neat thing about it is, no matter what, and they tell you that no matter how far down the scale you have gone, you can see how your experience can benefit others. If you're new here, I got to tell you, the information is in this book, and the steps from steps 3 to 11 are page 63 to 88, 25 pages. That's it. And they give you the exact instructions that you need to follow. And what to do? Do this? Do that? And for me, that was perfect, you know? And I got to tell you, I haven't had a drink since April 12, 1995, and it's strictly by the grace of God and the program and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and guys like Mike and Joey and Colleen and Mary Beth. And, you know, we got to do this together, guys. You know, we really are. I'm a hopeless, helpless alcoholic, and if I drink again, I don't know what's going to happen to me. And I'm going to say goodnight. Thank you very much.